And with us now is another food justice advocate and longtime sanctuarian, Jillian Nave. Jillian is a farmer and chef who uses her art, making food, to build a more just society in many ways. Thanks for joining us, Jillian.
Hello.
So, Jillian, one of your jobs is at a juvenile detention center. Could you talk about that a little bit and what you do there?
Sure. I've been working within the juvenile detention facility system for about 2 years now. And I teach culinary arts at one facility at Red Hook Residential. I teach microgreen and greenhouse growing at another facility that is a bit more secure. And then I teach outdoor raised bed gardening at a maximum secure facility that's in Goshen, New York. And it's been a lot of fun.
So is teaching like farming and food-related stuff in prisons and detention centers something that you went into intentionally or something that happened that you found your way in by accident?
I totally found my way into it completely by accident. And I got into the field by another collective that I've been a part of called the Chefs Consortium, which, if nobody knows what it is, it's a collective of chefs within the Northeast area. And we are all chefs that are connected to the local food movement. Either we own farms, work on farms, have gardens, or are obsessed with foraging. So we just want to advocate the local food movement in whatever catering events that we get outsourced to do. And so the creator of the Chefs Consortium that I've been a part of for about 3 years now, 3 or 4 years, is a contract chef for the Office of Children and Family Services, which the juvenile detention system falls underneath and is regulated by. And he just offered me a culinary arts position at Red Hook. And then once I was involved with one facility, two other facilities asked me to work for them as well. And I told them my skill set, which is farming and culinary arts, and they hired me to work for them. And I've been spearheading both of the programs at Highland, which is the microgreen program, as well as Goshen. It's the first of any programs or horticulture programs that have been there. So yeah, it's been really exciting to see the therapeutic effects that it's been having on these kids.
So why microgreens? I do a little farming myself too, and that seems a very specialized market.
Yeah, it is very specialized, and we wanted to feature microgreens for two reasons. One, you can do it indoors all year round. And two, we put it in the food and it boosts the nutrient density of the not-so-nutritious food that these kids are eating. Mm. And it only takes about a week to 2 weeks max to grow any of these microgreens. So it's that instant satisfaction and the instant gratification that these kids can see, because a lot of the kids are only there for about 3 or 4 months, 6 months max. So if they keep coming back to the microgreen program twice a week, they can really see the progress that, you know, it only takes so little time.
So is the intent, I mean, is it kind of like multiple benefits in terms of like the nutritional value that they're ingesting at that particular moment and also like a skill set for them to take away?
Yeah, absolutely. So it provides them job readiness. They can get a job working at a greenhouse, at a nursery. A lot of these kids come from rural central New York, so they're surrounded by a lot of farms and can easily get a job, or they live on farms, so they already grew up with that connection to the earth. But a lot of the times they just want to get off the unit. They want something to do. And it's a quiet place where they can come into the room. They know exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a time, and it's really like an hour and a half time where they can be quiet if they want to be quiet, or they can have a conversation with me if they want to have a conversation with me. So it's a lot of counseling. And I get high turnover, or I see a lot of returns too. So it's really, that room is very much like a safe space also, because it's very lush. We have house plants. We're getting succulents. So these kids are learning how to repot house plants and just to just have more control over an environment that is controlling them.
That's really exciting. Another work you've done, maybe a little closer to home, is the Uptown Summer Gardening that you did in 2016. Could you, well, maybe compare and contrast that work to the work you do in detention centers, but also just generally talk about what it was you were doing there?
Sure. So I did the Uptown Summer Program last year, and it was a lot of fun. I was here twice a week, and we had about 8 to 10 kids, depending on the day, sometimes more than that. So we worked with the kids in the morning, and they had, you know, experienced weeding. They helped cook the food that we would harvest and help grow. And it was generally a lot of fun. It's hard to get kids, you know, motivated to weed in the morning when it's like it was a very hot summer last summer. But I think they generally had a really good time. And just being here at the sanctuary, I mean, the kids loved it. So, yeah.
So, bouncing back a little bit, you covered a lot of this, but we have this pretty general question about, you know, what do you feel food plays or can play in the prison industrial complex? And maybe so some of the things that you haven't touched on yet that you want to add to that.
Yeah, definitely. So the reason why I even became involved in food justice to begin with was because I studied culinary arts. That was my background, specifically fine dining. Like, I've competed all over the country and have won awards. And upon graduation, I did not really feel connected to that scene. I felt like it was very classist and exclusive, and created this kind of like caste system within the food industry. So I felt like I needed to go back to my roots and kind of understand as a chef where my food comes from. And that led me to farming, which led me to teaching farming, which led me to so many other things. So I really feel like personally, in order to for people to get back to their roots, they have to learn how food grows, and also use food as a form of activism, as a weapon, and that comes with knowledge. So
have you interacted a lot with Soulfire Farm, or at all with them? Because I interviewed them a couple weeks ago, and it seems like a very similar message in terms of, you know, breaking down those barriers and food segregation. And empowering Black farmers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I visited their farm a lot. I've gone to their parties, which are very fun. But I wouldn't say that I've necessarily worked directly with them, but I think our ideals definitely correlate dramatically. They're doing amazing work, and I have so much respect for them. But yeah, it's completely along the same lines of helping to educate the kids that I'm working with about how they should try to learn these skills of farming, because it's how people in places have oppressed them in the past. And by gaining that knowledge, they're actually breaking those barriers.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Have you had success with like, in your relationships with particular kids in those centers, with, like, communicating that message? And have you found kids who are really passionate about what it is you're talking about?
I used to get really frustrated when every kid wasn't on board and would listen, and now I've come to terms with if just 3 or 4 kids, if I can get through to just them, I'm doing a good job, or at least I have to remind myself that. But I've definitely, within the last year, witnessed so much change, and a lot of these kids are now interested in just baseline farming, but just cooking for themselves, and also realizing that you can grow food anywhere, you know, on a rooftop in New York City, in your mom's backyard, or in a window. So Just making it seem more accessible as opposed to exclusionary, like farmers markets can be, or CSAs. Or, I mean, those are all amazing and I'm glad they exist, but I want to try to really make it seem accessible, like they can grow anywhere if they want to. Mm-hmm. And like at Red Hook, we just started a program called, it's a cookbook that we're starting, and it's called Doing Time in the Kitchen. And a lot, it's supposed to be a narrative cookbook, so a lot of these kids that are residents right now are writing recipes and stories associated with the recipes, and talking about food that they grew up eating, and maybe recipes that they cooked with their grandparents or their parents. So that's been a really amazing process to see unfold, and they're learning how to bind books. So it's a really interesting kind of bubble that I've am now witnessing. But yeah, I'm glad that there's some positivity happening at these places despite our whole prison industrial complex and school to prison pipeline that I'm witnessing so dramatically.
I wonder for you personally, I mean, coming, as you talked about, coming from this kind of elitist, like gourmet competition cooking scene, and then moving into this detention centers, to this disciplinary, like lower class scene, if there was a learning curve for you personally and how to engage with people and how to like, and like, if you could, like, did your relationship with food change when you entered the prison, or did you realize things about the way you'd been cooking or thinking about food before?
So, yeah, there was a pretty, pretty big learning curve. I went into Red Hook, where I originally started, wanting to like make a 3-course meal. I was like, these kids are going to love to learn how to cook, and we're going to be baking our own bread and pizza from scratch, and I'm going to teach them about sourdough and how to ferment. And that did not go over well at all. So these kids just want to learn how to make food that they're going to eat. So I've kind of backed off a lot and have realized that if they're just making some food from scratch and we're buying some supplemental food, then it's still getting them in the kitchen, and it's it's teaching them some skills, and it's basically like creating a positive environment around food, which is what we want to have these kids come away with. And the program, the culinary program, has become so successful at Red Hook that they're now in the kitchen with the cooks, cooking lunch for the entire facility, including staff. So they're serving the food. They can't, you know, use knives or have an open flame, but they can do most of the preparation besides that. We like prep that element. So they're super excited now, and that's kind of sparked the cookbook idea, and hopefully this program can move on to other facilities.
So. Do you ever try and sneak some of the stuff in? You know, like you went in with a preconceived idea about the fairly sophisticated process, you know, like
and
fermentation.
Healthy. I was like, these kids are going to eat so many vegetables, and
But the fermentation process, it, from the outside, it looks really complex, but really, I mean, it is complex, but it's also very simple. And I'm wondering if just through process you can get them going on it, and then you say, this is what you just did, you know? And then suddenly it's like this explosion of microbiological information.
Yeah, totally. So at all of these facilities that I work for, they all have gardens. So we harvest a bunch of food and bring it into the kitchen and cook it, which sounds like a dream, but a lot of these kids don't have any trust around farm vegetables because it's not what they're used to. So first it's developing trust that we're not poisoning them. So there's that. And also it's like getting them to actually taste it, which is like, it's just a kid thing. Like, kids don't want to try new things. It's called neophobia. They're scared of new things. They're scared of trying new foods. So it's getting beyond that. And I've seen a lot of change with these kids wanting to start to try new foods. But they are generally excited to cook anything. And once they have been involved in the cooking process, they're more likely to taste it. So... Mm-hmm. I would love to have everyone there have really great gut flora.
So we got maybe about a minute left, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you wanted to touch on. I mean, I have other questions that I want to ask you in terms of, like, you know, the idea of these kids helping write a book with you, and then you could go on, like, a little micro book tour, and you know, they could get used to public speaking and all sorts of stuff like that. Yeah, and get paid, right.
To, like, get paid a fair wage, because they're not right now.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. Cause I mean, a lot of the times they can't be involved in that process because we have to protect their privacy because they could be involved in a gang on Long Island or, so we do have to keep that in mind. But that would be amazing. Yeah, and I think it's really important for the public to understand what is happening at these facilities because nobody really knows unless you work there. The positive rehabilitation that we're trying to do despite the like handcuffs of bureaucracy that these kids are dealing with, and they're such victims of circumstance. So I would love to just shed as much positive light on it as we can, and then hopefully we can, like, figure out a way to change the system completely. I mean, they just raised the age to 21, I believe. So that means that everyone that's been, I believe everyone that's been tried under the age of 21.
Oh, so that's their record in Rikers. Can be cleaned.
Nope. So everyone that's at Rikers that's under 21 is now going to be under the umbrella of the juvenile detention system.
Okay.
So these facilities are going to expand so much because they have to account for all of those kids. So there's going to be some changes, but like I said before, I think that the more positive change that we can implement in these kids, the better, because it is a turning point. I mean, these kids can either take a change in their, like, take a stand on their lives and change, or, you know, they'll just keep going on the road that they're on.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jillian Nave sharing with us the many ways she uses food as her tool to build a better world. Thank you for all you do, Jillian. Oh, and just real quick, before you go, do you want to say a word or two about Oakwood Community Center and the Soul Cafe?
Yeah, I'm so glad that we could fit this in. So I've been involved in the Oakwood Soul Cafe for 4 years, and we are trying to get more people to come. So the next dinner is the Monday after Thanksgiving. So check out our Facebook page for that. And hopefully we'll see you. It's Dominican food. So please stop by.